Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
There's a battle going on between quantum physics and the old world of classical physics. And it's a battle which has gone on in the laboratories, in people's minds, and in the classrooms. And at the moment, it's really the time of the blitz, where classical physics is just winning in the classrooms. And it's winning for certain reasons. And people are going away, leaving education with a large lashing of classical physics and nothing, distrust and fear of quantum physics. And during this episode, I want you to join with me up in the gods, overlooking the battlefield and seeing the battles being fought out in the classrooms, where quantum physics doesn't get in the front door and classical physics is there and sold to the hearts and minds very early on, and trying to ask the question of, you know, what can we do differently? Can there be a brighter future, a world of quantum physics? And can we finally, after 100 years from the quantum revolution, I think the quantum revolution began really about now, about 100 years ago, can we finally plan a way forward into the everyday for quantum physics to come forward? So there again, I want you to not see yourself in the battlefront of trying to teach people or convince people one way or the other. Just fly with me up above the classrooms, look down and actually think about what's going on. First off, let's talk about where's the main battlefront, but it can continue much further. And the main battlefront is with the humble atom. So together, quantum physics and classical physics advance and we go into the world and we say, look, there are these things, these fundamental building blocks, and they're atoms. And of course, classical physics will describe it one way, with a little neutrons and tiny little electrons flying around. Quantum physics will describe it in a much more holistic, layered, mathematical way. The two ways. But on the way up, we describe things as atoms. Now, atoms, there's roughly 100 variety of atoms, depending on the number of protons in a nucleus. It has electrons around the outside. But I want to give a sort of introduction to it, such it's a bit more accessible. So I've been podcasting for a while, well, not really a while, just for a couple of months as I've been getting back up on my feet. And as I podcast, I go, oh, no. Look, it's going to be much easier to actually create a system of scales and discuss that system of scales to teach science from. And we might go back over that, but for the moment I'm saying, you know, I'm asking the same question, is there a system that we could actually get quantum mechanics up and running, get it off its knees? At the moment it's ruling supreme in the laboratories, supreme in the factories, supreme in our computers, but when it comes to actually the classroom, we just can't get it out. And it may be a concept too far beyond humanity. Humanity may never be able to get up to it before 25 or 30. It might be something like that. There again, it may not be. And there again, we might be actually doing things which assume that that's the way to go. So we are really telling us, our students, a fairy story, a fable of something where, I suppose, going back to it, the Peter Rabbit, where rabbits speak and hedgehogs, iron things, and mice and dogs and all that things speak. Well, and it's something very attractive. It can be something very done, but it's something which is very enjoyable to do, but it's not necessarily the next thing that you need to take with you to be a vet, so to speak. So it's true that the understanding's there, but it doesn't necessarily go ahead. But we're going back to atoms, and as I've said, that I have worked out, look, there's got to be six universes that does it all. So it's you expand something by a billion, you leave it the same, you shrink it by a billion, which is 1,000 billion, shrink it by a trillion, and then there's three other scales where it's 1,000 light years equals 1 millimeter, and I think it's only one other scale after that, and a billion light years equals 1 millimeter. I'm saying again, it's quite amazing, it's so simple to say, but in the very first scale, you expand it by a billion, which I've called the smaller verse. If I was to expand any typical atom, it would be the size of a large cake. I'm going to say cake instantly. People imagine cake and imagine slicing into it, imagining it not having any particular fabric or substance. That's right. There will be a little tiny chewy bit in the very centre, a raisin in the very centre, that's the nucleus. The rest of that fluff is electron. I've already stolen the show. And in an atmosphere where you're breathing in, there's an overall, and it's a gas, around atmosphere, there's roughly 3 metres between your cake and the next cake, which are bouncing around the place. And they're atoms. And that's a mutual thing. We hold hands with each other with classical physics. And quantum physics is going ahead. Now, let me tell you the strengths and the joy of classical physics and some of the structures that they use, and then you'll sort of understand some of the structures that I use to sort of counter all this. And I really can't believe I'm speaking after this. I've had, doing cardiac rehab just each day, podcasting for hours and hours on end, and hoping to get across, get some skill, and I podcast till I'm exhausted. I do fall asleep after hours of podcasting. And then I've just today done a few podcasts, had a bit of rest, and now I'm back up again. So, we're in our stories. We've got ourselves down into the worlds of atoms. You may know certain facts about atoms. Atoms pictured in liquids and gas and in solids. In solids, it's a lovely structured things like shelves of these cheeses. You know, these pictures of warehouses full of cheeses. It's sort of like going into a supermarket, so to speak, where you just look at rows and rows of these things served out. And we can actually see it now. We can actually now photograph an atom. That's correct. Now, there's the laws of quantum physics. It says you can't actually get light to photograph an atom. Uh-huh. Classical physics suffer that one. But we can actually do it very much like you're in the dark. At night, you're feeling, you want a snack, you go into the pantry and you feel the lumps. And as you feel the lumps, your brain can build a picture. And of course your computers can build a picture. And you can actually, with virtual reality goggles and a feeler, feel the bottles, the cans on a shelf. And you can similarly do that with a very, very fine atom size tip and subatom movement of that tip, which is available courtesy of other quantum mechanics. This is the piezoelectric effect, where 1 volt gives a fraction of an atom, so therefore I can move this around to get a tiny fraction of an atom by getting a tiny fraction of a voltage and oscillating it really quickly and actually doing some neat physics. You can imagine that if you are seeing your seeing, your beautiful opera singer, and you get this tiny bit of phlegm in your throat. You're told not to eat oysters, not to go out in the cold, and not to stand on 1 foot. You did the wrong thing. You got the lurgy, and you listen, and you can see, and some of you can really listen to an opera, can say, hey, that opera singer has got a bit of a lurgy in its throat. And the same thing can go for it in terms of that we just actually opera sing a needle above an atom, and we can actually hear that lurginess and actually go through and then produce the atoms in 3 dimension, and we can actually view these atoms that we're after. Now, I still haven't gotten into classical physics, but I'm just telling you that you can see atoms, and it's called the atomic force microscope. And do I know atomic force microscopes. I had my PhD, I needed something machined at the fantastic fantasy world of the Australian National University Research School of Physical Sciences. And could anything be done? No, mate. We're making these AFMs, and they're making hundreds and hundreds of AFMs. They're just chocking them out. And then eventually, I think it was my friend Peter... Oh, couldn't be Peter Dutton. No, it's Peter Drucker. Peter... Oh, I can't remember. Poor old friend. Upstairs, he had an AFM. And it's a little dome, and it's this little needle, which is pushed around by piezoelectrics, and oscillates, and its oscillations changes as it nearly touches an atom, and this is read back, and you get this virtual reality walking in atoms. You can walk around, you can push atoms, you can actually see atoms. The important thing is that we can see atoms. And what do atoms look like? Well, they look like your cake, they look like your cheese, they look like a big lump. They don't look like this complicated watchwork sort of Meccano toy that you really imagine in class. You can imagine when you're young, you'd go into the toy shops, thank goodness Toys R Us are gone. Well, I don't know. I sort of hated it when it was here and then regretted it when it's gone. Toys R Us has shut down. But in the old toy shops, you'd go in and you'd really, if you're buying a toy in a box, you want to actually see. It's got little bits and you can unfold it and instruction pieces and wires and bits and doodads. You know, oh, hopefully if I did take a photograph of an atom, I'd see all the electrons in the nuclei here. Oh, the pictures don't show that. Well, there are two explanations. The one explanation is your picture of the classical atom is a lie, and I'm telling you, it is a lie. In fact, I might change the word postulates to lie to see if you can actually take it a bit more. And there are two ways. You go up to the toy seller who's selling you these things, and you say, look, oh, I really want it. I must have it. I've been told I must have a toy with these things inside it. And of course, the wise toy seller will say, ah, oh, it really is in there. It's just, you can't see it. Oh, it's going to come out next year. One day we will bring it out. So please come back to our toy shop. Please keep interest in it. Please don't lose interest in it, because atoms actually don't have any of these working parts in it. In fact, atoms are far more beautiful than that. In fact, atoms absolutely fascinate me. And there's these software you can actually not build an atom in the old sense of the little electrons going around, but you can actually build an atom by building your own wave functions, and that is something which brings me great joy. It can bring you, your child, great joy next Christmas. But unfortunately, it's not there. And indeed, we have really in education, look, this is unscripted, totally off the top of my head, my self-conscious coming out, the crooked toy maker. The crooked toy maker who is not being honest with the kiddies, saying that indeed this toy which we're telling you of, these the talking rabbits and stuff like that, from Beatrix Potter and that type of stuff, that sort of thing isn't inside this box. In fact, this box only has, if I open it up, only has the foam and no toy inside it. It's actually just got foam inside it. And unfortunately, that's what we've photographed. We've actually photographed these toys, and they've only just got foam. So in a sense, the quantum mechanical world can be disconcerting to a kid who just really wants to see action and movement and stuff like that, to have still beautiful, beautiful foam area. And I'll discuss what that is a bit more, but let's get back to Bohr, and let's get back to 1916. We had Rutherford again in this fundamental lie world deduce the fact that inside an atom was a small little nucleus of charge, small little nub of charge with all the mass in the center. And going the way that Rutherford. So Rutherford is a Kiwi. He was up in Manchester, and the general idea is that Manchester was a rich place in England. England was on the rise again, and England wanted to have another place rather than Oxford and Cambridge. And so they just poured money into this place and Rutherford there, and they were looking at Marie Curie's fantastic radium, and there was gaseous radium, which is radon, which is producing these alpha particles, which they could emit the source. And what happened is that the alpha particles were going through materials but were spraying a little bit aside. So you can imagine your hose and you're hosing against a sieve. There was this slight sieving effect. So rather than a simple pure beam, there was this fuzziness. Now, contrary to popular belief, Rutherford got Geiger, who is a younger German, to look under a microscope at these tiny little specks, and under a lot of effort began to map the distribution of tiny little specks, and then just going forward, he said, hey, just check for a bit of backscatter. They found a bit of backscatter, and so Rutherford modelled the whole damn lot with Coulomb function, beautiful scattering function, and I suppose the myth is that Rutherford said, just looked at purely the backscatter and said, oh, from this, that's all I know. But he actually had solved the whole kit and caboodle, had got the entire size of the atom across, and people rushed forward. This is in the time before quantum mechanics, and you couldn't blame them because they didn't know quantum mechanics had come up, and said, well, if the world is the way we think it is, things which are smaller, like electrons, must be even teeny, itsy, teeny, weeny still. And of course they are wrong. Okay, so I'm not going to call it a lie, but it's a misconception that electrons are smaller than nuclei, because one of the beauties of quantum mechanics is they have an equation called the Schrodinger wave equation, and it tells you that the lighter something is, the bigger it is, just as well, because that's why the Earth is not a tiny little knot. We're actually sitting on the bulkiness of these big lightweight electrons. We're actually sitting on a big frothy ball of foamy ball of electron foam. You're sitting there. So you don't believe me? Well, go deny the laws of physics and become your electrons. May your electrons be classical, and may you sink to the bottom of the earth as a true classical believer deserves to do. But I sincerely don't think so. I do hope that you are quantum mechanical in nature, and that because of quantum mechanical in nature, and because you believe in the Pauli exclusion principle, your electrons will not fall through the other people, the Earth's electrons, and you will actually stay on the surface to listen to the end of this podcast, which is going at 18 minutes. I've got to get to a certain height. So just bear in mind that there's the Bohr thing, the Rutherford said this is a tiny nucleus, and Bohr, who's a pretty incredible person to understand, but he was someone who really believed himself. He was look, in Australia, I really can't say, he was, there's a derogatory term we have in Australia for people who allowed, believe in themselves, and won't listen to other people. And this is one of the things that's frustrating about Bohr, is that he had such a strong ego and such a not believe. He was important for a research group at that time, but he really wouldn't listen to other people. And so he came up with his postulates to try and get this grab bag of imagine how the atom was a toy, to get that toy to produce the most fundamental thing, and that is the spectrum of hydrogen. So hydrogen, let's do it, is the most basic and simple toy that you could have. So you can imagine the Thomas the Tank set, for all those things up to Spencer and Scarlowe and Mac and Elizabeth, all these complex toys. My simple one is Thomas the Tank number one. And hydrogen is your Thomas the Tank of your Island of Sodor periodic table. It's got a single proton, a single electron. The proton has got a positive charge, electron weighing 2/1000th the weight of a proton. It's got a negative charge, a positive and negative, like each other. And if you let, like any two magnets, a north and south pole, they'll slam together. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to slam together and bang, they'll just slam together. But wait, it requires someone with a very big, powerful ego to come in and say, but it doesn't. And the reason is because I bore tell you it so. Yes, add a bit of bore to the way that you think about things and you too can actually understand quantum physics. Not quantum physics, classical physics, because it is a classical world. And if you imagine that Bohr, through all this, did a bit of classics, got into a bit of the quantum physics, but he really never got it, because he had this fantastic thing. I can tell you a bit of Bohr. And so, what happens is, he needed to explain the spectrum. Now, the spectrum of it is that if you have a light source and you hold a prism up to the light source, you can get a beautiful rainbow produced from Roy G. Biv across. Now, I'm just trying to think. I think I've just got to really remember for glass where the absorption line is. So blue would be bent more, because it's so blue's at the bottom and red's at the top of the rainbow. I think that might be right. I've just got to go back. I've got to calculate the dispersion curves in my head for it. But it's basically a rainbow-producing device, and something which is big and dirty of a fair number of atoms, i.e. the sun, there's a fair whack of atoms there, that will produce a continuum spectrum. And a spectrum, it means, comes from the ancient word ghost, a spectrum, the ghost of an atom. So how you do it is you do a funerary rite. You know, when you cremate something, the ghost, the spirit is released. When you chuck a salt in a flame, say, you can do this yourself, going up to your kitchen and chucking a bit of sodium, good old sodium chloride, to get the sodium in there, and you'll get the yellow. The sodium ghost is released, the spectra, the ghost of it. And the way you do it is you can look at that ghost and, oh, it looks like yellow to me, but you can actually go across and actually see a little other little bits in it. Now, something which is very pure only has a few lines, and hydrogen only has a few lines, and it was obviously that it was obeying a certain law. And so a Bohr, with the thing of the model of his atom, his beloved atom, on the desk, a few papers, spectra showing that where the line should be, and a blackboard, he set to work day and night in his Danish laboratory, working across. And he eventually, you can imagine the chalk hitting the wall, the board and the things. He says, I've got the answer. And then this annoying person, possibly the cleaner, said, Bohr, g'day Bohr. It's probably an Australian cleaner for sure. G'day Bohr. Now look, there's several problems. And he says, I Bohr declare these postulates. And you might think that sounds fanciful, but we do it in the classroom every time. We say, now here is the atom. This is done by Bohr. There's a better one out there, but let's look at this one. And here are Bohr's postulates. But can I say, just for provocation, call them lies. Okay. So the first postulate slash lie is that the electrons shall travel in circular orbits around the nucleus. It is attracted to the nucleus, but rather than actually going to the nucleus is actually just not accelerating, it's changing its direction, so it's going around the circle. So it's, you can imagine a game, I think it's a Disney game, where you've got a center and you run around it circles and circles and circles, and those are orbitals. And you can imagine the Aussie cleaner going, "Bore, mate, you're saying a charge moves up and down like an antenna?" Yeah, well, that's what an antenna is. It's basically a charge moving up and down. Well, basically, you just described an antenna. But the problem is that's going to radiate heaps and heaps of energy, because that's just going to... the oscillation will put out radio waves, the portion. You just describe a radio transmitter. "Mate, what are you..." And he says, "Wait for a moment. I bore... change my postulates, my first postulate slash brackets lie, that it's an electron that goes in a circular orbit, but to solve the problem of it radiating, it doesn't." "What? It doesn't radiate." "Go on, look, it's just crazy." So the electron goes in a circular orbit and it doesn't radiate because Bohr says it so. So the proof is that you, Niels Bohr, say that it doesn't radiate. Okay. Let's move on. And the next thing is that they go in these circular orbits and there's different ones, and as I say that the electron at a particular point in time, which is to say on the outer, say you've got several orbits, several tracks that can go along, a particular time around, you could be running around a certain track, and as it does it, you're running around there and you go, woo, 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 disappear. You disappear, you're running around from ideas, right? There'll be a track at 10 metres, 20 metres, 30 metres, 40 metres going out. Really doesn't matter. And it goes out to infinity in actual fact, if you really want to know. Of these tracks, but that's all in the equations. And the electrons are moving around here, and you're running in the 20 metres of track, it goes, run. You run a little bit slower on the track on the outside. It's just like planets orbiting, you know, like how Uranus travels more slowly around than, say, Mercury. Mercury is whipping around. So you're out there, say, for instance, for real effects, let's say you're in the Earth orbit, and you're just in the Earth orbit, you're walking around on Earth, travelling on Earth, and then, Jesus Christ, you're on Venus. How does it happen? How does it happen, Bohr? Bohr, tell us how this happens. And Bohr says, "By magic, child, by magic. Because I've put that in that transition. The first magic, it doesn't radiate. The first magical postulate slash lie slash magic is it doesn't radiate. The second thing is that you're on Earth and you suddenly reappear on Venus. And that's an awful lot of energy gained. So that energy goes off with light. And in fact, if you've got a helium, a hydrogen light source, you'll see a redness in it. Helium neon laser, a red light source, and that's how light is produced. That is, you're mucking around, having a good time on Earth, and all of a sudden, to produce some energy, you're put into the Venus orbit. And indeed, that's actually true. The such transitions into the second orbital, which is the Venus orbital, as far as where the Earth planetary system is called, is put away. And that's how light is produced. And light is absorbed the opposite. You can be in the Venus one, and light can come on, and some energy comes in. Energy has been received by central solar system, which is called the solar system atom. Okay, I know what to do. And it presses a button, and magically you get beamed up. So you've got this beaming up, beaming across. Things travel faster than the speed of light. Sorry, Einstein. fastest speed of light between orbitals. That's just how are you ever going to sell it? I said, well, I'm a big looking. I've actually got a big head, and indeed, he does have a big head. When the British were taking him out of, I think it was Sweden, in a mosquito bomber, they put him in the bomb bay and put a helmet on him with a breathing tube, and so he wouldn't get exposed or die of exposure. But unfortunately, they didn't do the calculation for Bohr's big head, and so the helmet didn't go on his big head. So he nearly died when the British stole him from the Germans in a bomber, and a bomber flew over low and fast over, or not low enough, over the oceans back to over the seas to Ebony, Britain. That's a story of Bohr's head, but he's a good looker. I must admit, I don't go through the survey conference and actually say, Einstein, he's a bit of a fuzzy chap. I'll tell you what, that, I've forgotten his name, the name of the person for, de Broglie. He's a bit of a money man with money. Bohr, I like a big head. So, Bohr, sorry for any people, I actually, don't particularly dislike Bohr. There's a few, there are a few scientists which I thoroughly dislike. I think they're just rotten scoundrels. Bohr's not one of them. I think probably a rotten scoundrel will, Dewar and Ernest Macht, absolute rotten scoundrels. I just really irritate me. Bohr, he's an okay chap. I'm just making fun of him for the purposes of this podcast. So, you're the Aussie cleaner, you're cleaning up Bohr's, laboratory. He's got his model atom there, he's got his spectra here, he's got his blackboard, he's triumphantly bullying you, basically, into submission. He's your first complaint. The electrons don't radiate, they're in stable orbit, so they don't crash in, don't blow in, and they don't radiate. Why? Because Bohr says so. Alright, I just work here, I'm just a low life. Second one is, how do they absorb the light? Well, they just do. There's a beam me up, beam me down. Bohr, do you really think you're going to sell this? And the answer is yes. 100 years later, this is what we're still teaching in classrooms. We're still doing it. And if a teacher should dare say this is not right, the teacher next door just has to only put up his hand and say, well, I can't pronounce them because I don't speak their language. Like, like that. And you're gone. But there's more. The entire thing is that, boy, you've got this all set up for if you can add one more bit, one more equation into it, you can actually get it through. And he said, well, you know that bit of quantum mechanics coming through, Max Planck, Einstein, blah, 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 etc. I think the angular momentum, which is the, momentum is a, it's a physical view. Momentum is basically if you're in a playing rugby and there's a weedy person running up against you and you're a big tough person, they just bounce off you. They get really angry and they come back over the hill with a steam train, and that's got a lot more momentum, and then that certainly will plop you off. So momentum's that way. Angular momentum is like one of those playground spinny wheels. You get on, and you actually add more angular momentum to them. Angular momentum is this fantastic thing. It goes way out into cosmology, quantum mechanics. It's just the bee's end. That's the track that you work into, understanding so much physics through angular momentum. Your why things has been why the universe has got an absolute zero angular momentum. There's so much understanding and depth in angular momentum, and angular momentum began to come up with someone called Max Planck, a sort of a dubious character, rather sad character to come up, and he had his Planck's constant called H, which is a unit of angular momentum. So if you can imagine adding, you putting someone on one of these spinning things and you give them one bit of angular momentum. If you're naughty, I'll give you a whole lot of units of angular momentum and you spin them around more and more. And what Bohr said is that these orbitals go up. For the first orbital, you have one unit of angular momentum. Second orbital, you have two units. And can I have 2.1? No, it's quantized. You can only have one or two or three or four units of angular momentum. They go up in steps of angular momentum. Now, I just wonder if I think it's actually just H when you look it up. So angular momentum is a unit of spin. It's got the unit of joule seconds to the minus one is how H frequency, and H times frequency equals energy, and it's got angular momentum, which is kilograms meters per second. I think I'll just have to. Oh yeah, and times a meter. So the meter squared seconds to the minus one is the unit of H. It's a small unit. And I would have to actually think of a good way of memorizing Planck's constant. This is going to be a better way. This reminds me. But Bohr was saying it so. And Bohr, you're the Aussie cleaner back there with your hands underneath your chin and the mop supporting your hands, listening to Bohr. Bohr, what are you going to say? Oh, well, he says, well, my mate down in Krautland, Max Planck, has got this Einstein thing. Yes. Do you want to throw in a few more celebrities? I think back down there was celebrity. I don't think Errol Flynn. I don't know what some of the celebrities were down at that same. Name a few celebrities. Yes, yes. And just let me tell you, you could just make it another postulate. Yeah. Well, I've got two postulates. Einstein had two postulates. I'm going to have three postulates. Three postulates are better than no, or they're worse than postulates. So postulates are basically, they're not necessarily, well, this third one is just a fix. Other ones are out and out lies. You know, just, you know, but if you call it a postulate and it comes from someone who's famous, who's got a Nobel Prize, you know, we'll do it. So we have there the postulates, and those are the postulates which allow me, many years later, to go chunk on the board, just as Planck did for the nucleus, and draw these circles and say, this is how it works. And of course, it's the lie that's lasted 100 years and will probably last more, because this podcast is not going to go change. One of the things you realize that you do these podcasts, and some of the ideas go together, and that's not the purpose, it's just getting those ideas close together. So, we're getting 38 minutes in, which is what I've got to do. So, there's an aside thing of just podcasting for a certain length of time and getting things across. So, that's how it's gone. So, now we know the tactics used by the classical army. It's a bit like Dumbledore and Dumbledore's army and stuff like that. The other ones are well organized, the evil lord. I don't quite put Bohr and Voldemort together, but they're not too far off in terms of the rule of terror, rule of absolute educational terror associated with them. But we're flying above and we're looking above and we're saying, you know what? The quantum army needs postulates. Well, we don't mean lies, but we need basic things which you can hang on to to get an explanation going. One of the things we haven't done in quantum mechanics, we haven't attended to the educational needs that Bohr has attended to. Bohr, those postulates, are they right, are they wrong? They're things that are filling up the working memory of people and allowing them to understand his gear. And the problem is that once it's understood, quantum mechanics hasn't got a hope. And we're training people, you know, an army of drones two aspects. One is that they're controlled by remote control and they're following a process and don't understand what they're doing. It's like the entire idea is that a drone is not conscious. But also drones because they're droning on because of, we're giving them the actual tactics to win, and perhaps we should look at the tactics to go. So here's, now bear in mind I haven't really thought about this. I've thought more in terms of rehab of just get going and get things, but from doing all these podcasts I've got these recurrent themes which I'm saying. Now I'm not going to go back to the Bohr's three postulates. You can go into any textbook online, get the three postulates. Again, you're not going to be able to get a picture of an electron. You know, they're beginning to be really, the classical electron is more a laughing stock. Sort of, there's a bit of, look, we'll just go back to the classical electron. Bohr is giving an electron as something really tiny, but if you could shrink up even tiny, you could actually land on the electron in Bohr's classical electron. Bohr's tiny electron is a sphere, I think it would be a sphere. And on top of it, you could land on the surface of the electron, and inside it would be real solid electron, and outside it would be nothingness, but a whole heap of charge. So, sort of, if you're even slightly negatively charged, stood on the surface of an electron, you'd be pulled into it. This would really, so if you're positive, if you're a speck of positive charge, and you stood on the surface of an electron, you'd be slammed down at that scale. But this is all fiction, that the electron has a surface and has something that you could go down small enough with a little tool and actually start to dig up bits of an electron that's not there. And then people sort of whimsically say, well, Newton drew a point, aren't points real? Now, Newton didn't actually draw, but people after him drew points and had sort of maths fantasies, so it's sort of like a bad maths dream. Really, it is sort of a maths nightmare. But let's go off to what the postulates were arming the good army of quantum teachers, and we're not there yet. We don't exist in classrooms, we can't do it. But the first thing to say is that in quantum mechanics, there are no surfaces. There is nothing really solid. Things drift from nothingness, from void, to a location of maximum existence, and then as you walk away, it reduces. It is just like a vapor. You can walk through, and in fact, you can walk through a quantum mechanical wave function, and guess what? Quantum mechanical wave functions walk through billions of times a second. From the sun are streaming these quantum mechanical objects which have got no surfaces, and they actually go through you, and a bit at the leading edge they start to exist, and they go to maximum existence and disappear. This beautiful sensation, like a wave on the beach. You can stand in a wave, and a wave hits you and goes across. So quantum mechanics, the first thing is that everything is wave functions. There's no surfaces, and in as much, I'm sure a more poetic person can say, as well as there's no surfaces, things aren't, a certain thing is not, it is ish. That is, our idea of a can of soup on a shelf, it's there. You put your hand to the side of the can of soup, it's not there. You put your hand on it, it is. and then you put it out of, well, it's much more fluffy than that. You can actually feel the soup everywhere, and its existence really stretches throughout the universe, quite honestly. And then you come close, and there is a locality where it is isishness. I haven't quite got the word. I'm sure someone will come up with a better word for it. So that's our first thing of quantum mechanics, our first postulate, if you'd like to say it. Except postulates are, in this case, a lie, and it's not something that I, Peter Hill, as a quantum physicist, is telling you. Really, I'm not trying to go over it. You can take it or leave it and think about it. You don't have to believe it to get to the end of things. And the next thing is that quantum wave functions can go through each other. And this is the whole thing of neutrons. If I have a neutron, if I could reach out of this earphone piece in your head, imagine that some of you are listening to earphones or a car, a bit creepy. Sit beside you, and like, especially if there's an earphone, imagine I'm inside the earphone, and I step out of the earphone, walking around the ground. It's pretty roomy around here, mate. Pretty roomy. I've just got a neutron. Yep. You're gonna imagine that I'm in your earphone. I've actually walking around. Open. This is the most precious part of your brain. Open it up. And here I've got this ball of this neutron here. Here's the neutron. What's going to happen? Well, the neutron will explode in about 900 seconds anyway. But what will happen is that it's a quantum mechanical wave function. It's got no charge. It will just simply fall straight through you. So if you imagine that I'm inside your head and I've walked out of the earphone and in your head, but you can imagine that anyway, and I've dropped that neutron will actually fall right through the center of your head, through your mouth, and out through your body, and into the earth, because it's a wave function. Quantum mechanical wave functions don't have surfaces, and they don't stop each other. In fact, an atom is made up of a whole series of electrons, all of which are pretty much the size of the atom. Get that? So, if I have an atom, imagine that I'm going to fix an atom, and I'm going to fix you right. I'm going to get the nucleus, and the nucleus will be a tiny little speck, and then I put electron after electron. If I'm doing uranium, which I think has 92 electrons, I think so, I will have to have a big table. So, imagine that electron's the size of a dish. And in order to get that atom fully apart, I'd have to have a table 92 places long with dishes on it. And what happens is I stack them up, the dishes on top, but it's magic. It's actually the size of one dish. Great for packing. And this is why things can have such high density. Osmium, which has got the, is it osmium or iridium? One of those have got that greatest density. They're so dense because the same thing goes for neutrons and protons. They're also, they're again, who do you think came up with the liquid the liquid drop model of the nucleus? This is this spheres, the red and white spheres. Who do you think came up? Give you a choice. I'll give you a few clues. See if you can work out who came it up. No, I'll give you a clue. First clue is 1936. Yes, people did laugh at it. Okay. 1936, liquid drop. Yes, it is completely useless theory. It doesn't do any metastable stuff, any energy levels, like the atoms before did energy levels. This doesn't do any of that. Okay. I'll give you another clue. His name, it's a him. Okay, I've given that away. Danish. Yes, he's Danish. Okay. Can I give you another clue? He's got a very big head that doesn't fit in an aeronautical thing. Okay. I'll give you another clue. He's got four letters in his name. Right. Sure. Might leave it to the end. Okay. Another clue. He got three postulates. Yeah. Okay. Yes, he is the parent. Oh, I may as well say the father, because you know he's the father of the atom. Yep, I'll give you another clue. So it's the person who came up with the liquid drop model of the nucleus, the theory of it. I'll be really mean. I'm not going to tell you who he is. Okay, but he has been mentioned earlier on. I might have mentioned him earlier on. He also came up with that idea of the nucleus. But even those things which this person believed is little spheres actually exist within each other. And in fact, let's take a tour of helium, which is eye-wateringly quantum mechanical, because it's got two electrons. The first electron is an S orbital, and yes, as it was, it's not sitting around. It comes in from the void to maximum existence and out again. It has a maximum isishness around the very center of the atom. And the next electron, due to some beautiful quantum mechanics, has an opposite spin, and that is its angular momentum is somehow differently, and it's again eye-wateringly beautiful physics. It's got to spin down, and so the second electron slides through the first electron, and it's exactly the same shape and position but opposite spin, and it's not popping in and out of existence. Again, someone from the same school the postulates brought you the liquid drop also gives you the let's name it after the capital city of his homeland, Copenhagen School. It doesn't pop into and out of existence. That's the worst type of insane story I've ever seen. But it sort of destroys the beauty of it. It's sort of like you bushwalk to a beautiful sunset, and someone comes up of a view of the Blue Mountains or something like this beautiful panorama of it, and these little kids around sort of fighting over their Game Boy, and there's music, and such a trashy theory that one, in terms of appreciation of beauty. But we haven't stopped yet. There's a proton, two protons and two neutrons. Two protons spin up, two neutrons, a proton spin up, spin down, a neutron spin up, spin down, and the neutrons and protons have a different quantum number. So guess what? They all exist in the same point. So all six particles in a helium atom have their home address, or where their most is-ish, word like that, of address, wait for it, your home address. So can you imagine you're in an apartment block, and you're in the 0th apartment, and then the next person up is in the 1th apartment, the 1, 2, oh, like in the street. Their address in three-dimensional space is brackets, 0, it's got to be three numbers, comma, 0, comma, 0, and when you do the census of what's at 0, 0, 0, it's all six atoms. And is that not the most, well, for me, the most beautiful nucleus? And it's just such beauty when you come into quantum mechanics. So this is the second postulate, is that wave functions can actually go through each other. Now, the next postulates, I think, and I think we might just leave it at three postulates, because Paul did three postulates. This postulate is not such a comforting postulate declaring, in Bohr's postulate was that, the individual, so it's based upon lie upon lie. To understand the third one, you have to believe the lies of the last two. Well, I might do four postulates of quantum mechanics. Yeah, I'll do that there. So let's go back to the third postulate. I was just thinking of it as we're doing it. So our three postulates, two postulates so far, no surfaces, and they can slide through each other. Then the third postulate is that they can change shape. And you really need the fourth postulate to help you through with this one. Fourth quantum postulate. That is that they can actually be folded. It's like this foam. You've got a foam and you can actually twist it and put a twist in the foam, but it's a twist not the way that you understand it. It's a twist, a multi-dimensional twist. And these twists are quite beautiful twists. There's radial twists and slicing twists, and it's like knots. You can try your wave function in knots. Oh, dare I say this, easiness is called a wave function. And we'll get that in the last postulates. But these are knots, and these knots, when they're sprung, and twisted, they can twist a certain geometrical way, and each twist is, new twist is, wait for it, has an angular momentum separation of h, and it comes out of the equation. It's not declared, it's just nature of it. So a very beautiful thing, and you can actually see them, and I've done a YouTube of it. I might put it up there, of a hydrogen atom untwisting and generating and pulsating and producing light as it goes between two of these states, because although you can't twist it in classical mechanics, in quantized space, you can actually just get the vector moving from one point to the other and producing. You can watch it. It's a beautiful thing to observe. There's no trickery, there's no magic, there's no nothing. You know how we were said, I think in the second postulate, things disappear and reappear. It's just them untwisting and changing shape. And the third postulate of Bohr is included here, that it's directly H. Now there's a fourth postulate which is really necessary to sort of help you spend the effort of belief. And these wave functions, although they've got numbers, they're countable, like 1, 2, 3, they are functions. And that is, unlike how did you do in your latest math test? Oh, I got 32 out of what, son? Or 32? No. 50? No. 100? No. It was marked out of 1 million. I got 32 out of a million. But that's a unit. That's a unit. But a wave function is, how did you do there? And you say, well, I did e to the minus e to the minus in brackets x squared minus 32. Yeah, you then describe not a single point but an entire space. And a wave function is like this curve, and it starts at one point. It's like you draw a wave function, you draw a wave function, and you have to start off. It's got to be nothing at infinity, and when you draw to the other end of the page, which is the other end of infinity, as far as you're concerned, it's got to be down at zero. But in between, it can do all these beautiful things. It can't loop, it can't have enclosures. It's got to be a function. And the wave function, and so this is the mathematical aspect to get across. This is the fourth postulates. But these wave functions also are algebraic numbers. That is, besides being not a single number, they're actually a function. Okay, but there are functions which you can go along the shelf, and like you say, you've got, I suppose you can imagine as greyhounds. You've got eight greyhounds there, each differently. You can, this greyhound number, you can number the function number eight, and out walks that greyhound. So you can say the first energy levels, and out walks that one. The second energy level, another one walks out. So you can number them. They've got a quantum number, but they themselves are real objects, like your little greyhounds or your cakes or your cheeses, whatever you think, which has volume. And it is a function. So it exists at zero, to zero either side. It's sort of like your greyhound is not just all spread all over the place. It's there where the greyhound is, but there's certain bits of it which is definitely there. It's got certain features and functions. Now, but there's something else that would be a bit shocking. We can't sort of leave you without the actual function itself. Having an existence field. So a field is something where a region of space with a value associated with it. So like pressure, there's a pressure field. That is, if I've got my pressure meter, I can actually measure the pressure all the way around the place. There's no place where I just go, there's no pressure, and I sort of die or something like that. Or there's a temperature field. So it's a wave function is an existence field. That is, there's points in space which I can take my existence meter and pick up the fractional existence of that point in space. But it's not that the pressure means is just there and a little bit next to it won't work. It's actually a proper existence field. However, the numbers in my existence field aren't my counting numbers. I'm sorry to tell you, they're algebraic numbers. They're complex numbers. So what does algebraic mean? Well, you've got your arithmetic numbers, which come from doing simple arithmetic. That's plus, minus, plus, divide, stuff like that. But the moment you start introducing square roots, you produce a complex numbers, and you get a complex number. And so this is the last bit of the fourth postulate of, it's a wave function. Oh God, I'm going to have to try and remember it. Oh, I've gone for an hour. Bloody hell, that's great. Because I'm going to have to go back and see if I can remember the four postulates there. But those, a wave function is an existence field of algebraic numbers which correspond to the something which can be computed as an existence. So it's there. So let's go back and see if I can remember the four pure postulates of quantum mechanics. And these are the sort of things that Bohr did and has been so successful for 100 years. The first one is that wave functions have no surfaces. The second one is that wave functions, quantum things, can slide through each other. They are waves. The third one is that they can twist and untwist, with units of angular momentum emitting light. And the last one, which I'm struggling to remember now, is that they are indeed functions. Sort of slightly circular, but they are indeed functions. And what a function is, and their functions, the existence field of an object, an algebraic number existence field. That's what they really are. Now, this last one is going to leave you confused. Maybe a few confused people. Now, unfortunately, the story's changed. That indeed, it's one of these things which you can't comprehend. An algebraic function that you can't picture, but it's something that you can get used to. It's sort of like dealing with another culture. Ultimately, you're never going to actually fully understand another culture, but you can get empathy with it. So that's the way to go. So that's the end of this story, and that's incredible. I've reached my rehabilitation goal aplomb. I was aiming for 40 minutes, 50 maximum. That's the greatest. All the best for you. I hope that you survive out there. I hope you don't get mangled by a person, a born again teacher who's got is thumping the Bohr Bible and going to damn you to hell and brimstone. If they do, just join with me floating above the whole battlefront and just trying to think of the theory and tactic to get through. Thanks for listening. podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.